Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Congress ended months of political haggling and passed a bill cutting more than $38 billion from the budget to keep the government running for the rest of the fiscal year. But the battle begins again as the House votes on proposed cuts for 2012. And this morning, the Labour Department said higher prices for food, gas and rent have caused the Consumer Price Index to rise 0.5% in March. Joining me in the studio for the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup are Chris Sillizer of The Washington Post, Julie Hirschfield-Davis of Bloomberg News and Greg Ipp of The Economist. Thank you all for joining me.
Okay. Good morning.
The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. We will, of course, be opening the phones in just a while, so do call in with your questions and comments. And you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter as well. Julie, was there any chance that this budget plan might not have passed?
There was obviously a chance, but I think that the Republican leadership in the House was pretty certain that it would. I don't think anyone expected up until yesterday that they would lose quite as many Republicans on the spending bill as they did.
59,
a quarter of their conference. And it was definitely a wake-up call for Speaker Boehner going forward into this next round of haggling over the 2012 budget and ultimately the debt ceiling increase, that he's going to have to really find a way to work with his right flank to figure out a way to make that happen.
Okay, we'll talk about the politics more in just a second. Greg, we better look at actually what's in this plan, because there was some negotiation right up until the very last minute with Republicans saying, hold on a second, we thought we were cutting more than we actually are.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, after all the storm and drang about just how severe these cuts were going to be, the largest in history, we're told, of the discretionary side of the budget, it turns out there's less than meets the eye. The headline figure is $38.5 billion. As it turns out, when you look at the fine print, a lot of that money was money that had been authorized but never actually spent and was probably never going to be spent. For example, $6 billion for the census, but the census is already done. It's highly unlikely they're going to find something to spend $6 billion
on. How does this happen? How do we go from saying that we're going to cut $38 billion to actually saying that we're going to cut what? In reality, something like $350 million? That seems like a massive jump.
Yeah, and actually, if you include the likely spending on emergency military operations, there will actually be an increase in spending. Part of it has to do with just the odd way we do budgeting in this country, the difference between what we authorize and what actually gets spent. Now, Speaker Boehner has actually made the point, which I think is a legitimate one, that notwithstanding the sort of less than meets the eye cuts this year, it does establish a lower baseline for future years. So there is a sort of an austerity there that kicks in over time. But the other point there is that, you know, at the end of the day, this was still a political agreement. And one of the ways you get to an agreement is finding cuts that seem worse than they actually are.
Okay, Chris Sillizer, I mean, I'm still very confused about this. And I don't know if I'm just feeling particularly dim with allergies this week, but the numbers are just, this smoke and mirrors? Understandably, the American public's going to look at this and think, hold on a second, we thought we were getting one thing and we're getting another. And how on earth did this happen?
I mean, I think Greg hits the nail on the head, which is these negotiations and even the budget fight that I know we're going to talk about in 2012. I mean, the other thing that we have to always remember is we're talking about the 2011 budget. It only goes till September 30th, the fiscal year. The fight over this amount of money, the period of time in which it's being covered, is all so amazing given the entitlement reforms, things that we have to tackle that are far larger, both in terms of political challenges, but also in terms of money. But I think, to Greg's point, these are political documents. Everyone wants to cut, including President Obama. It's the devil is always in the details when you talk about the budget, which is everybody likes the idea of cutting. Everybody thinks our national debt is too high and we need to do something about it. But when it comes to the program that protects you or the program that is important in your district, people don't want to cut. And it's why I don't think you're in any kind of haze, Catty. I think that it is, in fact, less than meets the eye, certainly in this year. I mean, the idea that Greg points out, the idea that we're going to actually spend more money this year is a remarkable thing and shows, I think, to the average person why they're so kind of confused and in a lot of ways disdainful the way that Washington works.
Okay, Julie, judged by what we've seen this week, and I know that John Boehner says we've now set a baseline and we're moving in the direction of accepting that cuts have to happen, and the president has said the same sort of thing during his speech. This week, the IMF said the US is not taking its deficit seriously. Is it? I mean, judged on what you've seen this week, do you really think that America is now tackling its debt problems seriously or not?
Well, I think that even Speaker Boehner, who worked so hard to get this bill passed yesterday, would acknowledge that this was not the big step that they needed it to be. He changed the conversation. Now we're talking not about should we cut, but how much should we cut. But at the same time, I think that everyone acknowledges in the White House and on Capitol Hill that this next round about, you know, what are we going to spend in the 2012 budget? What is the entitlement picture going to look like? How are we going to change things so that we slow the growth of the real drivers of the deficit is where the meaty cuts are going to come. And it's where, frankly, the much more violent political struggle is going to be over, you know, what can we get done? What can get through Congress? And this, they don't have very much time to deal with this question because, you know, the closer we get to the date when Treasury says that the country's going to hit up against the debt ceiling, the more markets are going to be looking to see, is Congress really coming towards some sort of conclusion here to be able to get an agreement on debt reduction, or aren't they?
Greg, what's the politics out of? Julie mentioned earlier the test that John Boehner faced over just getting this budget passed. How's your reading of the politics coming out of that vote yesterday?
It's interesting. You could actually make a case on both sides of the argument. You could say that this shows the weakness of John Boehner because he cannot count on holding his caucus together because the Tea Party people, the ones who voted against it, are clearly of a mind to do as they wish. On the other hand, you could say that this actually makes Boehner look like a true deal maker because he put together a deal that actually involved a significant number of Democrats and Republicans voting for it. So if you're sitting in the White House, you might actually be looking at this vote and saying, there's a guy we can actually work with.
And you've got Republicans also who did vote for the bill saying, listen, we did come here. We feel that some people are going to say we cut too much. And we realize this is what divided government looks like. So you've got Republicans coming down on both sides of this argument.
Yeah. And in fact, it will be interesting to see whether today, when we're scheduled to have a vote on the much more aggressive 10-year budget resolution, which begins in the coming fiscal year, how many Republicans vote against that for the opposite reason, which is that it does too much.
Let's talk a little bit about the president's speech on Wednesday. He laid out his own budget proposals, Chris, and it struck me that that was as much a political speech as it was an economic speech.
I think that would be a kind reading. I think it was primarily a political speech. Look, the president has announced, well, he has announced he is planning to start raising money for re-election, which amounts to the same thing in the world we live in as announcing that he's running for re-election. I think it was very much a political speech. I think it was very much a speech given in response to the budget that Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin Republican, the 2012 budget that Greg mentioned that they'll be voting on today in the House, put out. And yeah, I mean, I think it seems to me if you look at what President Obama said in that speech, as well as what he said at several fundraisers that he did last night in Chicago to sort of kick off the campaign, what he is saying and the case he is making is for that this budget speaks to what kind of America we want to be. He repeatedly, both in his speech on the debt as well as fundraisers last night, used the word compassion, that we can be competitive and compassionate. And I think in a lot of ways that's how he views the budget, that this is about who we are and as importantly as it relates to 2012, Caddy, who we want to be as a people. You know, he made a very pointed argument against the Ryan proposal in that debt speech, essentially saying that it rewards the rich, it disenfranchises people who are already disenfranchised. So yes, a very political document and a very political speech that I do think we will keep coming back to as a touchstone as we get further down the road in the budget fight, and of course, further down the road we get in the budget fight, the closer we get to the 2012 election. I think we'll keep coming back to it.
And Julie, listening to the president on Wednesday, it struck me the tone of it, as Chris was suggesting there. He was actually talking to the liberal base of the Democratic Party much more forcefully and trying to woo them in a way that he hasn't done recently, that they felt they didn't have a champion in the White House, and perhaps they came away from that speech feeling, well, actually, yeah, this is somebody who's more in line with our broad economic and political philosophy.
That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, he has drawn a lot of fire, particularly in this last go-round with the spending bill and for this fiscal year, about that he has not been standing up for the priorities that his base champions, that he's sort of been co-opted into this discussion of we need to cut, and they've wanted him to step forward much more strongly and say, we want to cut, but we don't want to cut the things that make us what we are. We don't want to for instance, cut Social Security. We don't want to cut Medicare and Medicaid, at least not to the degree that Paul Ryan has said in his budget. You know, Obama invited Paul Ryan to his speech and sat him down in the same room while
And Paul Ryan came out furious saying, I don't know why I was invited. I felt like I was going there for a ticking off by the school headmaster.
Yeah, he sort of sat there stone-faced. And but I think actually that's important for the president to show to the base, to Democrats, that, listen, I'm coming into this conversation on, I'm acknowledging that we need to do something about the debt. We're going to have to cut. We just have to figure out a way to do it. But at the same time, I'm with you. I'm not going to abandon our priorities. I'm not going to be Republican light, and I'm going to draw the lines, you know, someplace at cuts that I consider draconian, and say that, you know, that's as far as we can go.
Okay, Greg, David Brooks in the New York Times today was outlining the differences in philosophy and principle between President Obama and Paul Ryan, saying the two actually haven't sat down for a proper lunch. They should do. Perhaps they might not agree, but at least they would understand each other. Give us a quick breakdown of how the president's budget proposal differs from that of Paul Ryan in economic terms.
Sure. Well, in broad numbers, Paul Ryan purports to cut the deficit by a cumulative $4 trillion over the next 10 years relative to what Obama's February budget would have done. Obama claims to cut it by $4 trillion, but he would do it over 12 years. So that actually is a less aggressive target than what Ryan has. The truth of the matter is neither of these is a budget in the true sense of the word. They are not thick with detailed policy proposals that the Congressional Budget Office can therefore say, this will raise this much money or cost this much money. They're much more visions. They're almost like dueling magic asterisks. You know what I mean? You have Paul Ryan saying, revenue will be 19% of GDP because I say so. And you have Obama basically saying, we're going to do much tougher action to control healthcare costs. But there, the substantial differences, as I think, you know, Chris was referring to, is about the visions of the country that these different budgets entail. In the case of Ryan, he's saying we have a huge healthcare problem and we're going to limit the federal government's exposure. In the case of Obama, he's saying we're going to get to tackle healthcare inflation directly.
Okay, Greg Ipp of The Economist, you're joining us for our domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined us for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. In the studio with me, I have Chris Sillizer, author of The Fix, a Washington Post politics blog. I have Julie Hirschfeld Davis here, congressional correspondent for Bloomberg News. Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor of The Economist and author of The Little Book of Economics, is with me in the studio. A lot to talk about in terms of the budget. We've been talking about the different plans that President Obama and Paul Ryan have put out, the president's speech, of course, on Wednesday night, in which he really did take it to the Republicans and lay down his vision of how he wants America to be, and it was substantially different from that of Paul Ryan's. But actually then afterwards, Julie, he sounded a little bit more conciliatory on Thursday. He said he'd called a meeting with Bowles and Simpson and that he wanted to solicit their ideas. Is he rowing back a little bit from what might have sounded like, right, here is the Democratic position and it's very different from the Republican position?
Well, I think he had to do that first, right? He had to sort of set out the markers and say, you know, and give the contrast of what his vision is versus the Republicans' vision, so that he then gives himself room to do what he and, you know, Democrats on Capitol Hill as well acknowledge has to be done, which is to find some way to come together with Republicans on some measure that would do something about debt reduction and frankly, you know, reach some agreement on the 2012 budget, because they're going to have to do that. that. So yeah, that is going to involve, you know, looking at what the Bowles-Simpson Commission did and seeing how much of it can fly on Capitol Hill and you know, what he can get Republicans and Democrats to really agree to. That process is going to be very difficult because there's a bipartisan group on the Hill that's been working for months on this, and they tell the Gang of Six, they're called in the Senate, three Republicans and three Democrats, they tell us they're getting close, but they're still hung up on, you know, some pretty contentious issues. And those little details, those last hang-ups, are sort of the big enchilada when it comes to figuring out what this deal is going to look like. What are they going to do on entitlement cuts, and what are they going to do on taxes?
Yeah, Chris, my sense is that the Bowles-Simpson plan is buried under about 5 foot of dust right now, and that the prospects for any kind of bipartisan resolution, whether it's Bowles-Simpson or the Gang of Six, have been scuppered slightly by the very partisan tone that we've had over the last week.
I think it's certainly set it back a bit. Remember, when Bowles-Simpson came out with their recommendations late last year, the criticism certainly from Republicans and even from some Democrats and some in the media was that the president essentially ignored it. You know, this was his commission to address what is widely agreed upon as the biggest problem facing the country. And he said very little about it. In the run-up to the debt speech, we heard the kind of leaking outs was that he was going to embrace the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which, you know, I'm not sure that he entirely did. So it is the Bowles-Simpson Commission recommendations are, in fact, not a political document. You know, we're talking about right. political documents and non-political documents. That is not a political document because both of Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson have a very important thing before their names, former White House Chief of Staff and former senator. And that allows you to make honest recommendations outside of the political
view. Because you're not
running
for re-election.
But of course, we are then trying to wedge it into the political process where, you know, the House and Senate, all these people are running for re-election. The president is running for re-election. I think that's to Julie's point. That this, the Gang of Six has taken months and months and months, and we're close, and we're getting closer, and we're getting closer. But ultimately, there's either going to have to be a proposal or not. And, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the president's debt speech, what did we hear? Well, this probably won't get resolved until after the 2012 election. I mean, you know, we're kind of back to where we started.
Okay, Sandy writes to us from Alexandria, Virginia. The Democrats consistently lose the tax arguments with the Republicans. I don't understand why they don't constantly put out that we are now waging three wars and have lowered taxes, an unprecedented occurrence. They need to make the argument that we all need to sacrifice to pay for these wars, and simply cutting spending won't touch the deficit or debt, as the Republicans claim. Greg, we did hear the president say some of that, didn't we, on Wednesday?
Well, absolutely. In fact, he said more strongly than I've heard him say before that he absolutely will not countenance another extension of the tax cuts for the wealthiest 2% of households. That's pretty strong stuff, and I think it puts down a pretty important marker for coming negotiations. The problem he's had up until now is that much as he would like to only extend the tax cuts for the 98% of the middle and lower part of the spectrum, is that the Republicans don't want to cooperate with that. And last December, when we were weeks away from the expiration, which would have caused all those tax rates to rise, the administration basically crumbled because they were afraid that that would do severe damage to the recovery.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about other news, and a lot of it is economics. This week, this morning, the Labor Department reported a 0.5% rise in the consumer price index. Julie, is this more than just high oil prices that are driving prices up?
Well, I think so. And I think, you know, this is going to be we're going to increasingly see, you know, the Fed has said that they're beginning to see improvement in the economy. But as gas prices go up and we're entering the summer driving season,
with improvement
now,
comes inflation.
Yes. And you know, any recovery is obviously going to be slowed with these increases. So this also becomes something. It's become a theme on Capitol Hill. We hear more and more about gas prices. Now Republicans are blaming President Obama, saying he needs to allow more production. And President Obama, in his budget, said that he wanted to end tax subsidies for oil companies. And so Republicans have branded that the minivan tax. So this becomes a real sort of political hot potato, but certainly
those
a very,
soccer moms back in the political
right?
field again.
But certainly a substantive problem for any economic recovery that might be taking.
Do Americans need to start worrying about interest rates going up?
I don't know. I mean, the Fed has basically not changed its position on this, and I think that, you know, that gas prices have not been high enough or long enough for them to say that it's going to have that influence. But it's definitely something that everyone has to keep an eye on, given that everyone acknowledges that whatever recovery is going on is still very fragile.
Chris,
I was just going to say, you know, with the economy particularly, and Julie gets at this, the numbers almost matter less than the perception. And that's the difficult thing that the Obama administration has run into is, you know, it's so perception driven. People forget when Ronald Reagan was reelected overwhelmingly in 1984, the unemployment rate was still over 7%. The issue that worked for him was the trend line was trending downward. So I think part of this is it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If people feel better about things, then they go out and spend money. So these mixed signals are difficult for an Obama administration that's really hoping to push that unemployment number down, down, down as we get closer to November 2012. And if gas prices do rise, as we expect this summer, that will be a difficult hurdle for them. Not because anyone, I think, blames Barack Obama for the fact that they pay more at the pump, but when you pay $50 or $60 to fill up your tank of gas, it is harder to believe the economic recovery has begun in earnest.
Right. And Greg, the relationship between gas prices going up and unemployment coming down, which is the number that is going to sway politics more, or are the two so inextricably linked that you can't separate them?
Well, they are linked because one of the things that's been happening is that gasoline has now risen roughly a dollar per gallon in the last 3 or 4 months. That could actually wipe a full percentage point off of household incomes. By way of comparison, that's almost as big as the tax cut we got in December. We now know that the economy probably only grew around 1.5% in the first quarter, which is a painfully slow rate. People were actually thinking it might be growing 3 or 4%. So that rise in gasoline is directly dragging the economy back and will make it harder for the unemployment rate to come down. Both those things are going to be big barriers to Obama.
And the prospects for gas prices coming down anytime soon?
Very poor. Because essentially what's happening is you have both supply being constrained by problems in the Middle East, Libya's exports almost completely shut in, and continued rampant growth in demand in countries like China, which are still growing very rapidly.
Okay, let's talk about this story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about the banks being near a deal with the SEC. The Journal is reporting that securities regulators are in talks with several major Wall Street banks to settle fraud allegations. According to the Journal, these expected settlements could mark the biggest attempt by enforcement agencies to hold Wall Street accountable for its role in the subprime mortgage bust. Julie, what do you make of that?
Well, I think we're still sorting through the sort of wreckage of the meltdown of a few years ago. And we saw on Capitol Hill this week a big investigative report came out about the investment bank's role in the whole mess and misrepresenting, at least the congressional committee said, what they knew to be the case about these securities that they were dealing in and having a direct hand in the housing collapse and indeed the entire financial meltdown. I mean, I think that this is going to be an increasing issue as we see whatever the details of that settlement might be, just how...
Are we going to see big fines? I know Goldman's already paid fines last year. Do you expect any of these banks to be paying fines on those sorts of levels?
I think it's hard to say. We've seen some fines assessed, as you said. I think it's hard to say what we're going to see in the future in terms of fines. But, I mean, I think one of the bigger issues is whether we're going to actually see any criminal charges. I mean, the Senate committee that put out its report this week said that they were going to refer their recommendations to the Justice Department and to the SEC to see, you know, what could be done about them. And so, you know, I think it remains to be seen whether there'll be criminal penalties, but there could very well be some steep financial penalties for what went on.
Chris?
You know, what's difficult here, I think, is that Julie mentioned this, that we're still – I feel like we're still trying to untangle the web of what led us to the subprime mortgage crisis. When we do that, it is human nature, certainly American, the way that we do things in America is we want someone to blame. We want a scapegoat. Goldman Sachs is a scapegoat, certainly, just because of the amount of money that they made off of it. The banks broadly are. But, you know, I think in reading about it, in doing some reporting on it, it seems to me, this doesn't mean that we won't scapegoat the banks. Let me put that there. This was a very complicated thing in which a number of people at a number of levels could have helped cut it off and did not. And so I think, again, it's always the policy versus the political. The political is searching constantly for a scapegoat. The banks clearly, you know, we're talking about a 640-page report that basically excoriated the banks for their role in this. I don't know if that ultimately, if doing that will ultimately keep us from going down this road in the future, because I think it's too easy a solution to too complicated a problem.
I wonder if many people listening both to the fact the news that the federal regulators are talking to the banks, and also looking at the investigation by the state's attorneys generals, whether they're going to think, how does this affect me? Does this make any difference to the rate of foreclosures in the country? Is it going to make it easier or harder for people to stay in their homes? And that's really the bottom line that people want to know now. I think, to some extent, you know, the kind of who should we blame for the financial crisis, I feel like the political wind has kind of gone out of that. But I do think people are very focused on whether this is going to make a daily impact to them.
Right. And in fact, there's actually two separate sets of talks going on. The stuff that the Senate and the SEC are talking to the banks about has to do with bad stuff that they allegedly did before the crisis began. The more important thing going on is a settlement this week between the federal bank regulators and the largest servicers of residential mortgages that has to do with screw-ups on foreclosures since the crisis happened. And that's very much ongoing. If you recall, we had allegations of robo-signers, you know, people that were basically signing documentations that were foreclosing on people without actually ever reading it. We had banks supposedly throwing people out of their homes while they had, on the other hand, already promised to modify their mortgage. The settlement says basically the banks can't do that any longer. If you've already offered somebody a modification, you may not proceed on foreclosure. If you hurt somebody, you have to pay them back, and you have to hire all these extra staff to deal with the huge backlog you have. Now, interestingly, the state attorneys general, which are also investigating the banks for exactly the same problem, have decided that they actually are not satisfied with that settlement. And they could yet, you know, reach something even more sweeping that might involve the banks having to put up money to write down the mortgages that some people are struggling to pay.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to call us, do join us on 1-800-433-8850 is the number, or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. We are going to go to the phones now to Greg in Northern Virginia. Greg, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show. Greg, can you hear us?
Yes, hi. I'd like to make a couple of quick points for you guys to consider, and then I'll take the answer off the air. First off, it seems to me that both revenue and spending have to be approached in this mess, or we're not going to get anywhere. And it seems to me that since we all acknowledge that we want to cut, but the devil is in the details, why is it not realistic to simply say we are going to cut across the board 2%, 3%, 5%, everybody gets to share the pain, everybody gets to share in the glory, everybody gets to say to their constituency, I did my best for you. And it seems to me that it's more important that we cut than what we cut. The second point I wanted to make is that on the revenue side, I don't understand progressive and regressive taxation, but I guess I don't understand why the most regressive tax we seem to have is the Social Security tax, because we only tax up to a certain dollar value of salaries. And it seems to me that if we just said what you make gets taxed at this particular amount all the way through the year, that we would create a significant new revenue stream. It would come all from people who had money. And I guess I don't even understand what the justification for not doing it was.
Okay. Okay, Greg, I'm going to put those two points to our panel. That's interesting thoughts there from Greg. Greg, you start with the idea that it's not really what we tax specifically, but the fact that we need to cut tax, that we need to cut across the board.
Well, that's an interesting point, actually, because in theory, you don't want to just take this meat axe approach and cut everything the same amount, because some things may deserve to be cut 2%. Some things should be cut more than that.
This perhaps is the president's point, isn't it? You
exactly,
want to take the scalpel and cut
well,
carefully.
Well, frankly, that's the point of all politicians, really. But because politicians have so much trouble agreeing on what they should cut, one of the most important proposals in the president's speech was that if Congress fails to agree on what they should cut, they will have these fail-safe triggers, which will do exactly what the caller has suggested, impose across-the-board cuts in spending and increases in taxes.
But these triggers historically don't have a very good track record, do they?
I would call it a mixed track record. The most famous was the Graham Rudman Hollings Balanced Budget Act, which did not actually balance the budget, but did get deficits down. In the 90s, we had things like discretionary spending caps, the Budget Enforcement Act. It did help. I think, though, the significance of this is really, and by the way, this is an idea that the Gang of Six has been working on, and that, I think, is where Obama got it. I think the idea really here is political. It's This is the thing that perhaps the Republicans and the Democrats can agree on and therefore pave the way to raise the debt ceiling, as Julie was talking about earlier.
Okay, Julie, what about Greg's point on simplifying the tax code so that we could increase revenues that way?
Well, I think, I mean, everyone is talking about simplifying the tax code, and
that's not necessarily in Greg's way.
Not necessarily in Greg's way, and politically that could be difficult for a variety of reasons. But, you know, what we heard President Obama talk about in his speech was tax expenditures, this idea that there are elements of the tax code that are actually, that he characterizes as spending, really, because they're directed toward a specific industry or a specific practice that the government had, you know, decided to incent in some way. And so there are all these, and it makes the tax code obviously much more complex. And the idea that the Simpson-Bowles Commission came up with was to sort of take a wholesale look at the tax code and see if we can get rid of some of those and in the process bring the rates down. But politically, it's very difficult because when you take away some of those things, it's a tax increase. And we've seen, you know, the Grover Norquist from Americans from Tax Reform, who's a very strong force in the Republican Party, just sort of write that off, absolutely a non-starter, and it's going to be very difficult for Republicans to agree to anything like that.
Okay, Julie Hirschfeld-Davis is congressional correspondent for Bloomberg News. We're going to take a quick break now. A lot on the economy and the budget, clearly, to talk about. I want to get to the 2012 campaign as well. Quick pick on air traffic controllers. We may even swing by Wisconsin and what's happening there. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. drshow@wmu.org is our email address. Do stay with us. More on our news roundup after this.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at RWJF.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. France and Britain criticize the roles of NATO and the US in Libya. Egypt detains former President Mubarak, and Japan says its nuclear crisis is on a par with Chernobyl. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined us for the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup. I'm joined in the studio by Chris Sillizer of the Washington Post. Julie Hirschfeld-Davis is here from Bloomberg News. Greg Ipp is with us as well from The Economist. He's also the author of The Little Book of Economics. Let's go back to the phones now to Hamish in Sycamore, Illinois. Hamish, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My comment is that the Republicans and the Democrats have had 100 years to get this job done and get it done right. This isn't a fraternity fight. We're the ones that are taking all the suffering. They need to figure out how much money they have coming in. In 2009, there were 97 people who made over $500 million. For the year. 31 of them paid zero in tax. Big companies like GE paying no tax. We need to get income and then start cutting. We need to find out how much we're making, and then we can cut accordingly.
So, Hamish, you're saying deal with the revenue side as well as dealing with the spending side. And, of course, we've seen, Julie, some of that this week. You know, it is interesting that there's always this perception, I think, that Americans have an allergy to raising taxes. But when you look at the poll numbers on this, actually 2/3 of Americans say that they want a combination of cutting spending and raising taxes.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, people do say that they want to see spending cuts and they want to see Congress do something about the debt and the deficit. They want to see the White House and Congress come together on that. When you ask them about the specific cuts that you would need to get there, they're less enthusiastic. Almost across the board, any of the moves that you know, if you look at the results of polls, people say, no, I don't want to cut Medicare. I don't want to cut Social Security. I don't want to, you know, do any of those things. Foreign aid spending is definitely a big, you know, applause line among the public in terms of cutting, but it's 1% of the federal budget. So you can see where the difficulty is there. On taxes, you're right. You do see big majorities who say, at least for the wealthiest, we would be willing to tolerate higher taxes. But politically, I think it's still very difficult for members of Congress to wrap their arms around that. And you've seen some, Republicans are against it. You've seen some Democrats, in-cycle Democrats, who are also very wary of raising taxes in any way, particularly individual income taxes, because they don't want their constituents to, they don't want to be branded as a tax and spend liberal. And that's sort of the rap that they'll always get from Republicans in a political context on this.
And it's kind of interesting, isn't it, Chris, that, you know, when the news comes out that GE doesn't pay taxes and that there are, as Hamish was pointing out, a certain number of people who are extremely wealthy, who are actually paying very low tax. I think the real rate is something like 17% for the top 1% of the country, that there isn't more suggesting that perhaps they could shoulder a bit more of the burden. And I noticed the very careful language which the president, that we're not trying to bash the rich in any way at all, but this is a question of providing and the American way of providing for people who are the poorest amongst us.
You know, I tend to think, Caddy, that most politicians who are by their nature cautious, by and large, tend to be lagging indicators of where the public is on almost everything. They kind of come late to things that are changing within the culture. I wonder if taxes is one of them. I think Julie is right. There is a huge resistance. Before President Obama spoke on Wednesday, John Boehner came out and said, if there are tax increases included in this, it's a non-starter in the president's budget. That was it. So there is a huge resistance, particularly among Republicans, but more broadly too, to trying this in the political class. Now, the question is if you took that first step, would the American public congratulate you? Would they believe in the skin in the game argument that Mark Warner, Saxby Chambliss, the members of the Gang of Six are trying to make, that everyone has to have something that they're going to be unhappy about in order for us to get deficit down? There's the political calculation. There's huge fear. There's huge fear of going anywhere near taxes. Particularly Democrats worry about it because they don't want to be branded tax and spend liberals, which is why, to your point, Barack Obama went out of his way to say, you know, this isn't taxing. These people need to pay their fair share, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just so fraught politically. But I wonder whether the country has moved beyond where the politicians are on the issue.
Yeah, that's very interesting, whether there is a lagging indicator issue there. Okay, 2012. Time for a bit more pure politics. Greg, you wanted to talk about this. In fact, you wanted to talk about the Donald. Before we talk about the Donald, let's talk about Rick Santorum, who is also suggested. I love this idea that you suggest that you might suggest that you might explore the possibility of jumping into the race.
Right. How many steps do you have to go through before you actually do jump into the race?
How can we take all of the drama out of this?
Yeah. So Rick Santorum, you know, he's forming his so-called exploratory committee. We also had Mitt Romney, you know, the least surprising nominee of all, you know, forming his committee. I actually kind of feel sorry for Tim Pawlenty, who was sort of first out of the gates of this group. But he doesn't seem to be doing well in the polls. The stunner this week is that you have Donald Trump, of all people, tied for first place in some polls.
And you were writing about Tim Pawlenty this week, Chris, about his making his moves and hiring pollsters and sounding more serious about it, although, as Chris says, not doing particularly well on the name recognition front.
What I always say about a presidential race, especially, Caddy, is that it's like an iceberg. 90% of it is below the surface. 10% of it is what people actually vote see. We're in the 90% phase at the moment. These exploratory committees, fundraising, hiring staff. You know, what Tim Pawlenty is doing is systematically building organizations both at the national level as well as Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, these early states that on paper should make him competitive. Now, what we've learned and keep relearning is that candidates ultimately do matter. You know, I think it's easy to forget that sometimes mm-hmm. if you're like me, you focus so much on the infrastructure and the strategy and all these candidates matter. On paper, Mitt Romney should have been the presidential nominee in 2008. He had all the money. He was positioned roughly right. But he got beat by a guy who had no money and no organization in Iowa, Mike Huckabee. Why? Because Mike Huckabee was a very good candidate. In fact, a better candidate than Mitt Romney. So I always try to take a step back. It's easy to get lost in the minutiae, to stand too close to the picture. But you really have to take a step back, say it's still very, very early on. We're still operating underneath the surface as it relates to voters. And so I tend to give these guys a little bit more leeway in that, you know, things that we may blow up as, oh, this is a huge mistake. I use the my parents test. If my parents haven't heard of it, it's probably not a huge mistake because it hasn't penetrated even the casual political observer.
Julie, I mean, it's too early to say who exactly is going to be the lineup, clearly, and some candidates are very late getting in. Does somebody like Rick Santorum getting into the race change the equations for the others who might be thinking of getting into the race at all?
I think it's difficult to say. You know, Santorum, the former senator from Pennsylvania, he's staked a lot of his career and his reputation on his pro-life stance. He talked about it when he announced that he was forming his exploratory committee. It's hard to know in this kind of political environment whether a candidacy like his could really catch fire with all the focus on fiscal issues, the economy, and jobs. It's just not something that he's really known for or has talked very much about publicly. And I would mention that to Chris's point about all the sort of below the surface operating that's going on with the people who we know are thinking about being candidates taken seriously as prospective candidates, you do also have the Donald, who has said that he may, in the season finale of his show, The Celebrity Apprentice, announce what he's going to do, whether he's going to jump into the fray or not. So you have these very attention-grabbing people who are not necessarily seen as serious contenders, who actually are kind of mixing up the fray quite a bit.
Okay, we're all loving the fact that the Donald might run. And it's kind of, you know, here we are, we might have a fun race. And thank God for American political campaigns, because they always provide a bit of color. But is there something serious that we're overlooking here, Chris?
Here's what I would say. I do not think he is a serious candidate for president. I know that may sound crazy, given that there's polling that suggests he is tied for first place. But my guess is, and my strong belief is, the best day Donald Trump would have as a presidential candidate is the day before he announces for president. Because once he becomes a candidate, the level of scrutiny, I just don't think he can stand up to it. I do think there is something important to be taken from the fact that he is as high as he is in polling, Caddy, and that to me is that there seems to be either a dissatisfaction or just a lack of excitement among Republican
right.
voters for the field
for
that they
candidates.
Do have. Look, Donald Trump would not move mm-hmm. into 17, 18, 19% of the vote on name identification alone, if there was a strong front runner. There is not a strong front runner. I think people are still looking around. It's why anytime I talk to any group of people about the presidential race, they always say, who might get in late? You know, they want to know about Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. They want to know about Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida. Now, I don't think those people are running, but it's that belief that the field just isn't of a certain level yet. Not that Donald Trump would make it of that level, but people are just interested in whatever the new thing is, and he happens to be the new thing at the moment.
Right, and it's worth remembering that whoever does get the nomination instantly becomes more recognizable, gets the party machinery behind them, and starts to be taken more seriously just de facto by being the nominee. We're getting several emails in, like this one from Gail in Seattle, who writes to us, Americans are not looking for a scapegoat in the financial crisis. We are looking for accountability, justice, punishment, and reform. In the savings and loan scandal, hundreds were indicted. Investigations should be thorough and ongoing, Julie.
Yeah, I think that's a prevailing view. People are still very angry about what went on. And, you know, this report that we saw this week didn't really have anything new in it that people didn't already suspect happened, but it was just more evidence of what had gone on and what everyone suspected had been going on. And I think you really haven't seen you haven't seen criminal penalties. You haven't seen people go to jail. It's not like the Enron situation. And I think people crave that. What you have seen is financial reform. You have a law in place that Republicans in Congress are now trying to dismantle pieces of. They were trying to stop funding for pieces of it. So there is going to be a political struggle over that. But I think that in general, people really do want to see more accountability than they're actually going to get at this point.
Okay, let's go to Donna in Brattleboro, Vermont. Donna, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. A first comment is that I believe that all of our elected officials are not in the same wage-earning category as most Americans. And I think that that is a problem in that it's theoretical about how Americans spend their money and what's best for Americans. They all earn well over $100,000 a year, and it takes a lot of money for them to even think about running for office. So I think they're out of touch. The other thing I'd like to tell you is about I have a small business here, and every year in Vermont we have a 6% sales tax holiday. And that holiday generally produces more revenue for small businesses, which we have in Vermont, than any other day of the year. And that includes Christmas. It's not true across the board, but it's generally true. And the big joke among us small businesses is that when we run a 10% sale or we run a 15% sale, we never have the amount of traffic that that tax holiday generates. So I think it's something the Republicans understand about public not wanting to pay taxes. The tax word is bad. And I think that the tax holiday kind of proves that.
Donna, that's a really interesting point. Greg?
I actually don't think politicians are really as out of touch as the caller suggests. I think the issue is that the people that they hear from are often themselves quite divided on what they want. And I think this actually proves it quite nicely. The Republicans are very attentive to the concerns of small business people, such as the caller. And that's one reason why they're so adamant that there should be no tax increases at all. Whereas the Democrats are much more in tune with people who want to maintain the social safety net as it is, and therefore they're more willing to consider higher taxes to pay for it.
What do you think about her comment about the tax holiday?
Well,
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? That you have a tax holiday and traffic comes into your shop, but you have a sale and less traffic comes into your shop, even though people might be saving more.
Well, think about it. A tax holiday is obviously very highly advertised because it's going on across the entire state, whereas a sale may only be in one store. But what we know from these holidays is that they don't actually cause sales to be higher. They just actually borrow sales from a later period as people rush in to take advantage of it.
Okay, I want to do quickly, we have a few minutes left on the program. Chris, air traffic controllers. Is this a big problem?
I was going to say, as someone who was on a flight yesterday and the day before, yes, it's a big, of course. I mean, I think we were all shocked to learn that there in Washington at National Airport, there was one air traffic controller at night. I mean, that's a stunning fact. I think we've seen a head roll. The head of air traffic control for Federal Aviation Administration has been removed. They are moving to shore it up to have more people in the towers. Plane travel in this country, look, anytime there is even a plane spin out, a landing gear doesn't go down. It is at the top of the news and it is on cable all day. We are fascinated by plane travel, fascinated slash frightened by plane travel. So I think it will continue to kind of play a role in our emotional and psyche. And I think that's why we're so drawn to the story. Hopefully these changes, I say this as a flyer. I mean, hopefully these changes will take effect quickly. Everyone was amazed to find out the staffing issues that were present.
Okay, and just before we end the program, I wanted to talk a little bit about Sydney Harmon, who died this week at the age of 92. He is, of course, the co-owner of the newly merged Newsweek Daily Beast company. He died suddenly. He was 92, but he died fairly suddenly. And Greg, does this make a difference to the media landscape now that Sydney has gone?
Well, let me just say on a personal note that long before I had ever heard of who Sydney Harmon was, 30 years ago, my brother, as a teenager, bought his first stereo receiver, and it was a Harman Kardon. And to me, for years, symbolized the leading edge of high fidelity sophistication. And so, to me, it's...
And certainly a wonderful philanthropist in Washington.
A wonderful philanthropist.
And
his company continued to be very successful. But, I mean, also from what we know, just an incredible polymath, you know, interested in the arts, you know, served under Jimmy Carter and the Commerce Department. And then late in life, into his 90s, getting in as a media mogul.
Let's hope that we're also fabulously active at the age of 92, Chris.
You know, just in terms of Newsweek and Daily Beast, Barry Diller, his co-supporter in this adventure, said that Sidney had made very clear in his last month of life that he wanted to continue on with it, and they expect no interruption in terms of their march to becoming kind of a news magazine online venture hybrid.
And he has designated his son, I understand, to be the heir apparent, his 29-year-old son, Daniel, a student who's at Columbia Business School, Sidney Harmon, who died this week at the age of 92. Chris Saliza, author of The Fix, a Washington Post politics blog, and managing editor of postpolitics.com. Julie Hirschfield Davis, congressional correspondent with Bloomberg News. Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor of The Economist magazine and author of The Little Book of Economics. Thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. We're going to have the International News Hour coming up next. I'm Caddy Kay of the BBC. I've been sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.